So it's zero subpoenas obeyed, one Republican for impeachment, and 23 Democrats for president. It was my understanding there would be no math on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. In the 46 years since the Roe decision, abortion continues to be a political punching bag with no end in sight.
We've been through almost exactly these same fights in exactly the same position. Right now, again, it is perceived that there are 5 votes against Roe v. Wade on the Supreme Court. And so we see both sides gearing up and suddenly more interest in this issue.
Plus, Michigan Congressman Justin Amash is the first House Republican to call for Trump's impeachment.
It's just not something you do to take on a president of your party this directly and then stick around and run in his party. But I think there's a possibility Amash checks out of the party and runs as a Libertarian for president.
And will New York Mayor Bill de Blasio's sour poll numbers at home haunt him on the presidential campaign trail?
The source of frustration with de Blasio's presidential aspirations is some people don't think he would be a good president. Other people think he needs to focus on what's happening in New York. They elected him to run the city, and this is more than a full-time job.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 278 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. It's been tempting to get sucked into the ongoing saga of House Democrats issuing subpoenas for testimony or documents involving Trump administration figures and having the president ignore everyone or forbid anyone from appearing before the committees. But we're going to stay away from that drama for now because it's become monotonous. And frankly, it's not going anywhere. But I have to confess that sometimes when an administration figure does come before Congress to testify, it can be fun. That was the case Tuesday while listening to HUD Secretary Ben Carson testify before the House Financial Services Committee. Lawmakers were asking him questions that clearly befuddled him. In this instance, California Congresswoman Katie Porter wanted to know about REOs, real estate properties owned by a bank after they've been foreclosed. Here was the exchange.
Why is FHA, to use a term that I think we can both understand, lousy at servicing mortgages?
Okay, I have not had any discussions about that particular issue, but I will look it up, find out what's going on.
So as you look it up, I'd also like you to get back to me, if you don't mind, to explain the disparity in REO rates. Do you know what an REO is?
An Oreo?
An R-E-O. R-E-O.
Real estate?
What's the O stand for?
E-organization.
Owned. Real estate owned. That's what happens when a property goes to foreclosure. We call it an REO. Mm-hmm. And FHA loans have much higher REOs. That is, they go to foreclosure rather than to loss mitigation or to non-foreclosure alternatives like short sales than comparable loans at the GSEs.
I would be extremely happy if you'd like to have you work with the people who do that.
Well, at least Carson came through later when asked what he enjoys most about HUD. He said he really enjoyed Paul Newman's role. Okay, so maybe I made up that part. Also on Tuesday, there were 2 elections of note. In Pennsylvania's 12th congressional district, vacated by Republican Tom Marino, the special election was easily won by State Rep Fred Keller, who keeps the seat in GOP hands. And in Kentucky's gubernatorial primary, Democrats nominated State Attorney General Andy Beshear to take on GOP incumbent Matt Bevin in November. Beshear is the son of former Governor Steve Beshear. And that leads to this week's trivia question. Who is the last son or daughter of a governor to go on to win election as governor on their own? Send your answer to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
I am a child
I last a while. You can't conceive of the pleasure in my smile. You hold my hand, rough up my hair. It's lots of fun to have you there.
The nation is torn over abortion again. The Republicans are passing measures in the states restricting abortion and are hoping the Supreme Court will overturn the 1973 Roe decision. Again, Democrats are saying that the GOP is restricting women's reproductive freedom and arguing that female voters will take out their anger against the party of Lincoln. Again. The script sounds quite familiar. Only in some ways, this feels more dramatic than ever, more urgent than ever. Under a president who once, 20 years ago, proclaimed himself strongly pro-choice, Republicans in a growing number of states are passing laws that ban abortion after 8 weeks, with no exceptions for rape or incest, like in Missouri, or no abortions after 6 weeks, like in Georgia, or 18 weeks, like in Utah, or no abortions at all, ever, like in Alabama. Abortion has been part of the partisan conversation for at least 46 years. And I get the sense that Julie Ravna has been covering the issue for nearly as long, or maybe it just feels like that. Julie is the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News and the host of KHN's podcast titled What the Health. And I know her as my good friend from NPR, where she previously covered health policy for 15 years. Julie, it's great having you back on The Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me.
Well, 46 years since the Roe decision, and I want you to take us on this magical mystery tour of the past. When would you say abortion first became a major issue politically?
Well, it was really in kind of the late 1960s. It was interesting. There's a study that came out a couple of years ago about how Patrick Buchanan, who was then working for Richard Nixon, thought that he could use abortion. And before that, abortion Republicans had been mostly pro-abortion rights. But Buchanan thought that Nixon could use it to kind of divide the religious, mostly Catholics in the Rust Belt from the other Democrats. And Nixon became anti-abortion. And, of course, we've seen that be, you know, we've seen the parties sort of diverge ever since. There are fewer and fewer what you call pro-life Democrats and fewer abortion rights supporting Republicans. We've now sort of retreated to the point where the Democrats are the party of abortion rights and the Republicans are the party of anti-abortion.
Now, I remember, I mean, I especially after the Roe decision in 73, I remember in 1976, Jimmy Carter saying he supported abortion rights, even though personally he was against it because he's the evangelical Christian. I remember President Ford saying he opposed abortion rights, even though Betty Ford was a very strong pro-choice, pro-abortion rights supporter. But I don't think abortion really, in a presidential race, really came to the forefront until 1980 with Ronald Reagan.
No, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, and even then, there were the public has always been kind of in the middle on this issue. Depends how you ask the question. I think generally the public believes that they don't like abortion. They disapprove of abortion, but they think maybe it's not their decision to make. That's kind of where the public is. So you used to see sort of, you know, Democrats like Bill Clinton who said that, you know, abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. And Republicans, you know, even to Donald Trump today saying, well, he opposes abortion. He's going to appoint Supreme Court justices who oppose abortion, but he believes they should be allowed in cases of life endangerment and rape and incest. So there's at least a little bit of a nod to the sort of great mushy middle that's where the American public is on this issue.
And I think if anybody was giving a nod to the mushy middle, it was I think of Ronald Reagan, who even though he spoke the talk, but remember when he was governor of California, he passed his very liberal abortion law in 1967, and he picked Sandra Day O'Connor and his vice president picked David Souter for the Supreme Court, who were hardly, anti-abortion activists.
Well, in fairness to Reagan, I think they didn't know that at the time when they were chosen. I think that came as something of surprise. It obviously made the pro-life forces a lot more, it got their antenna up a lot more about prospective Republican Supreme Court picks, which is kind of how we are where we are today, which is the perception that the more recent Supreme Court justices appointed by Republicans are assured to be anti-abortion because the anti-abortion forces wanted wanted to make sure of that before they were nominated.
And didn't Donald Trump promise that he would appoint justices who would overturn Roe?
He did indeed. And he sort of surprisingly put out a list of justices before he was elected president, pushed by anti-abortion forces who were a little bit dubious about Donald Trump because, as you pointed out, he had been rather vociferously pro-choice earlier in his career.
It just feels, though, that there was a time, and you mentioned Bill Clinton, there was a time after the during the 92 campaign and afterwards during the Clinton presidency that the pro-abortion rights group seemed to be on the ascendancy. And I know that Republicans didn't make their cause any easier when they had candidates, for example, like Todd Akin, who was a Republican candidate for the Missouri Senate in 2012, who was asked this famous question and came up with this infamous answer.
What about in the case of rape? Should it be legal or not?
Well, you know, people always want to try and make that as one of those things. Well, how do you slice this particularly tough sort of ethical question? It seems to me, first of all, from what I understand from doctors, that's really rare. If it's a legitimate rape, the female body has ways to try to shut that whole thing down.
Julie, it's 7 years later, but legitimate rape.
Yeah, well, we had one of those, last week when a lawmaker, also in Missouri, state legislator said that, talked about consensual rape, which he has since apologized for. But, let us say that there are many men who are not that comfortable talking about women's reproductive health because they don't know a whole lot about it. And, of 46 years of this debate, that has not changed a whole lot.
When I heard him say consensual rape, I thought that I've never heard anything. I mean, the two words back to back are just so antithetical to common sense. But anyway,
he was talking about stranger rape versus non-stranger rape. But it is still rape, which I think someone made clear to him after he said it.
You know what's strange, though, that we're talking about where we are now in the present, and, we have had anti-abortion presidents before, Reagan and both George Bushes, but I don't remember any president, anti-abortion rights or pro-abortion rights, who has used the issue so explosively like Donald Trump has.
Well, and I think part of that is, it ebbed and flowed basically depending on where the Supreme Court was. From about 1989 till Clinton got elected in 93, this was a gigantic issue because it was perceived that Justice O'Connor and Justice Souter would provide the fifth vote to overturn Roe v. Wade. And of course, in 1992, instead they voted to uphold it along with Justice Kennedy, who we didn't know was going to be the sort of swing vote on abortion at that point. So there was a thought that, oh my goodness, Roe is really in the balance. There may be five votes to overturn it. And we saw a lot of debate on a number of issues. In fact, we had a huge fight over exceptions for rape and incest in the appropriations bills, the so-called Hyde Amendment, which, by the way, had no exceptions for rape and incest from 1981 until 1993, when Henry Hyde, of all people, put it back because he was going to lose the entire Hyde Amendment if he didn't. There were the Democrats got it through the House and the Senate, and President George H.W. Bush vetoed it because, like some of his predecessors, he had been pro-choice at one point. He actually was the House sponsor of the Federal Family Planning Bill. So he was doubted by the anti-abortion forces, and so he therefore vetoed the bill, and the veto was just barely upheld. So we've been through almost exactly these same fights in exactly the same position. Right now, again, it is perceived that there are five votes against Roe v. Wade on the Supreme Court, and so we see both sides, gearing up and suddenly more interest on both sides in this issue.
It's remarkable to me that given the fact that it seems to be more and more efforts made in states around the country to curtail access to abortion when polls show overwhelmingly that the American people do not want a rollback of Roe versus Wade. But this is, I thought this was a turning point on the anti-abortion side. And this was, of course, obviously it was – interpreted by different people, but there was an interview with Virginia Governor Ralph Northam. It was on Washington radio station WTOP, and it was asked this hypothetical question not long ago about late-term abortion, and let me play his answer.
If a mother is in labor, I can tell you exactly what would happen. The infant would be delivered. The infant would be kept comfortable. The infant would be resuscitated if that's what the mother and the family desired. And then a discussion would ensue between the physicians and the mothers.
I mean, first of all, whatever he said and whatever he meant, but that immediately led Republicans and President Trump and Fox News to talk about infanticide and that they're ripping the baby out of the mother and they're executing a baby after birth.
Well, of course, what he's talking about is comfort care versus heroic efforts when an infant is born and has some sort of problem that is basically incompatible with life. And there is a decision to be made at that point. And no one is killing the baby. The question is whether, you know, how hard you're going to fight to keep alive a baby whose life expectancy is often only hours or days or sometimes weeks. But there's two real truisms in the abortion debate. When you're talking about abortions later in pregnancy, the anti-abortion side is winning. And when you're talking about abortions earlier in pregnancy, the pro-abortion right side is winning. Because the one thing we do know about public opinion is that abortion is more okay earlier in pregnancy and less okay later in pregnancy. And so obviously the anti-abortion side would much rather be talking about, you know, 9-month gestation fetuses, and the abortion rights side would rather be talking about the morning after pill, which is pre-pregnancy and preventing pregnancy. But the reason that's come up is because of where we are with the Supreme Court. We're seeing states passing all these abortion restrictions trying to get to the Supreme Court so they can have a vehicle to overturn Roe. In bluer states, they're actually trying to scrub some of their pre-Roe bans off the books, because what Roe really did, it didn't say that abortion is legal. What it said was states, you can't ban it. So it took all the bans that existed at the time and said these are no longer operative. Well, a lot of them never got repealed. If Roe were to go away, some of those would just come right back into force. So that was the context of what Northam was talking about. And this happened in New York too. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, male legislators have trouble talking about women's reproductive processes that they don't really understand. And we've seen on both sides lots of things that probably in retrospect some of these legislators wish they hadn't said.
Well, thank you for that interpretation of what Northam said, because here is President Trump's interpretation at a rally last month in Wisconsin.
Your Democrat governor here in Wisconsin shockingly stated that he will veto legislation that protects Wisconsin babies born alive. Born alive. The baby is born. The mother meets with the doctor. They take care of the baby. They wrap the baby beautifully. And then the doctor and the mother determine whether or not they will execute the baby. I don't think so. Incredible. No, it's incredible. Until this crazy man in Virginia said it, nobody even thought of that, right? Did anyone even think of that? You hear late term. But this is where the baby is actually born. It came out. It's there. It's wrapped. And that's it. Who believes it?
Julie, have you ever heard that language from anyone in responsible public office before?
Well, no, but it's not the first time we've seen this issue. Back in 2002, Congress passed something called the Born Alive Infant Protection Act. Again, as I said earlier, when you're talking about abortions or when you're talking about anything later in pregnancy, then the anti-abortion side is winning. And so this was a bill that they basically got all the Democrats to vote for because, according to the Democrats, all it said was, you can't kill a baby once it's born. That's already murder. And so they're trying to do sort of another version of that because that one became law. So the Republicans are pushing yet another version of this, both at the federal level and in some states, again, trying to trap Democrats, trying to trap abortion rights supporters into saying, you know, well, if we don't support this, then therefore we support infanticide. So we've seen this exact line of argument before. There's almost nothing new in the abortion debate. It just ebbs and flows.
Did what happened in Alabama, did that change the conversation? Did that change the equation as far as whose side, I hate to do this, put this in crass political terms, but did it change the perception of which side was winning. I mean, they were even quoting Pat Robertson. I mean, nobody quotes Pat Robertson unless you like to make fun of him, but they were quoting Pat Robertson saying that Alabama went too far.
Yeah, I mean, I really think it did change the national conversation. I mean, you do, you know, again, I think that there was, that the anti-abortion forces had the abortion rights forces on the ropes, if you will, in the early part of this year. And now I think it's reversed. There's a long time till the next election. Who knows what else is going to happen in the interim. But yeah, there is, you know, politically at least a perception that because, you know, now, again, we're talking about abortion earlier in pregnancy. That's where the public is more with the abortion rights side, as opposed to talking about abortion later in pregnancy, where the public is more on the anti-abortion side. But, you know, what's interesting, I was kind of surprised to see everybody, you know, suddenly get all excited about the Alabama law when we've had 4 6-week bans already passed this year. That's before most women know they're pregnant. There's not a whole lot of difference between a 6-week ban and a total ban. And as you mentioned, we had just an 8-week ban passed in Missouri, some other bans. But all those sort of short-term bans are basically the same in how they would operate in practice. And they're all efforts to, you know, to get a case to the Supreme Court, although the Supreme Court has a bunch of abortion laws to choose from already if they want to roll back or reverse Roe v. Wade.
I know Democrats who are running for president in 2020 are using this as a key issue, a big issue. I mean, I don't know if one candidate is more out front on this than others, but I saw that Elizabeth Warren introduced a bill to take the abortion protections as outlined in Roe into federal law. Now, that sounds great for a Democratic audience, but this is a law that, this was something that would ostensibly be voted on by a Republican Senate. I can't imagine that going anywhere.
It didn't, you know, also this was tried before. It was called the Freedom of Choice Act. The Democrats were pushing it in 1993 when Bill Clinton got elected.
When they had the Senate.
And they had the Senate and they had the House. And they couldn't get it through because, you know what? There were a lot of Democrats at that point who were anti-abortion. They couldn't even get it out of the House. Now, I think probably this House, which is much more supportive of abortion rights than the Democratic House in the 1990s, perhaps could, but you not only would need 60 votes in the Senate, you would need 60 votes in the Senate and not any anti-abortion Democrats, which it sounds implausibly difficult to do. So it's hard to imagine, you know, if that bill couldn't get through in 1993, it's basic, which did exactly the same thing. It codified the protections in Roe v. Wade. It's hard to imagine how it could get through now.
So I guess the final question is, what happens next? Does Alabama or some other new state law make it to the Supreme Court? And the obvious final question, is Roe in trouble?
Well, I think the perception is that, yes, Roe is in trouble. But that's exactly what we thought in 1992 when Roe improbably got, you know, reiterated and, you know, it got modified, but basically...
Was that Webster?
No, Webster was the one that said that the states could impose more restrictions. That was what sort of set everybody off and got everybody all excited. It was Casey in 1992 where they, you know, sort of re-ratified Roe and said, although they changed the it is now states cannot pass restrictions that create a, quote, undue burden on a woman's right to obtain an abortion prior to viability. So that's actually what the new standard is. The new standard is not Roe, it is Casey. But certainly there is every impression that, you know, and they actually struck down some Texas restrictions in 2016 on a 5-4 vote as being an undue burden. But of course, Justice Kennedy was still there. Justice Kennedy has now been replaced by Justice Kavanaugh. Justice Gorsuch has taken Justice Scalia's place. So there is the impression that there are 5 votes to modify, roll back, overturn Roe v. Wade. But again, you don't know what's going happen until it happens. That's sort of how the Supreme Court works.
Julie Rovner, the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News and hosts their podcast called What the Health. Julie, thanks for making sense of this very difficult issue.
Thanks for asking.
From the time I fall asleep till the morning comes, I dream about you, baby. And I feel all right because I know tonight I'll be with you. Smiling when the weary day is through.
The question about impeaching President Trump became ever so slightly more bipartisan this week with the decision by Michigan Republican Congressman Justin Amash to join the cause. Amash, a libertarian who sometimes strays from GOP orthodoxy, became the first in his party to call for the president's impeachment. And he went on to tweet that Attorney General William Barr has, quote, deliberately misrepresented Mueller's report. Contrary to Barr's portrayal, Amash wrote, Mueller's report reveals that President Trump engaged in specific actions and a pattern of behavior that meet the threshold for impeachment. The result was predictable. Republicans, starting with President Trump, went on the attack.
Well, I've known him, and he's been against Trump from the beginning. He probably wants to run for some other office. I don't think he'll do very well. He's been a loser for a long time. Rarely votes for Republicans. And, you know, personally, I think he's not much.
And here was House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy on Fox News.
You've got to understand Justin Amash. He's been in Congress quite some time. I think he's only ever asked one question in all the committees that he's been in. He votes more with Nancy Pelosi than he ever votes with me. It's a question whether he's even in our Republican conference as a whole. He had a very hard time winning in the last election, so I wonder, maybe he wants some type of exit strategy, but it's very disturbing. This is exactly what you would expect from Justin. He never supported the president, and I think he's just looking for attention.
Even Mitt Romney, one of the few Republican members of the Senate who has not hesitated to speak out against the president, had this to say on CNN.
My own view is that Justin Amash has reached a different conclusion than I have. I respect him. I think it's a courageous statement. But I believe that to make a case for obstruction of justice, you just don't have the elements that are evidenced in this document. And I also believe that an impeachment call is not only something that relates to the law, but also considers practicality and politics. And the American people just aren't there. And I think those that are considering impeachment have to look also at the jury, which would be the Senate. The Senate is certainly not there either.
Democrats, to no great surprise, lauded Amash for his courage. Amash has separated himself from the Republican pack before, most notably earlier this year during the House Oversight Committee's questioning on Trump fixture Michael Cohen. While every other Republican on the panel did the obligatory Cohen trash talk, Amash was the only one to ask him serious questions, such as...
You suggested that the president sometimes communicates his wishes indirectly. For example, you said, quote, Mr. Trump did not directly tell me to lie to Congress. That's not how he operates, end quote. Can you explain how he does this?
So what's next for the Michigan congressman? Todd Spangler is the Washington correspondent for the Detroit Free Press. Todd, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
Thank you for having me, Ken.
Well, the kind of independence we're seeing from Justin Amash, that's not out of character for him, is it?
It is not. Congressman Amash has been this way, an independent force since he came into Congress in 2011. He's never really played well with the rest of the caucus. In the very beginning, he ran afoul of then Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan and refused to go along with the majority's thoughts for what they were going to do with the budget that year, got tossed from that committee. He constantly stakes his own ground. There's nothing unusual about this. And he's never been particularly fond of President Trump, and he's made that known.
Well, wasn't he the only Republican to vote against Trump's national emergency plan for a wall?
Right. He was the only person to do that. And that's not to say that, you know, as you know, there are other Republicans who do occasionally break from what the president wants. In Michigan, we've seen Congressman Fred Upton, who is in a tough district, do that a couple of times so far this year. But with Amash, you get somebody who does seem to try to stick with certain principles. Over the years, he has been somebody who has voted and has caught hell for voting against defunding Planned Parenthood or taking funding away from NPR. Now, his rationale for those things has not been because he likes government funding for NPR or for Planned Parenthood, which he will tell you, quite frankly, he doesn't, but that he believes government shouldn't be used to go after individuals, that there should be policies that say none of the, you know, if you're not going to give money out to certain organizations or certain for certain things, say exactly what you're not going to give money to and stop it. Don't just pick on Planned Parenthood for political reasons. He doesn't think that's right.
Well, when you talk about principles, I mean, the House Freedom Caucus, which he helped start, used to be known for its independence and its advocacy of constitutional philosophy. But after Amash made his call for impeachment, the group blasted him.
That's right. Well, and even you got to realize that 2 years ago, we were having this conversation about Congressman Amash and some of the other members of the Freedom Caucus, because they were the ones in the House who were slowing down then Speaker Ryan and President Trump's ideas for how they're going to rewrite or get rid of Obamacare and rewrite the Affordable Care Act. Amash was one of those, along with, you know, Mark Meadows and Jim Jordan and others who were saying, wait, we want this plan to do more. We want government even more out of health care. And it was at that point when the president's, one of the president's advisors said, well, we might go ahead and try to primary Amash next time around. We don't like him. We don't like what he's doing. Eventually, that all got worked out with the Freedom Caucus. This time around, you have, you know, Amash still saying, wait, I don't know that I'm on board with this, but the rest of the Freedom Caucus saying, hold on, we don't think that the president should be impeached. And frankly, they don't, and have been talking for some time, they don't understand why the Mueller report went on as long as it did.
Well, talking about what happened, what was like 2 years ago, here's a little piece of tape from Jim Jordan, the Ohio congressman who heads up the Freedom Caucus. Here's what he had to say about Amash 2 years ago on CNN.
Justin Amash is a good friend and one of the most principled members of Congress. And frankly, if he is primaried, I'm going to do everything I can to help him.
I wonder if he feels that way now.
I don't think so. I mean, and by the way, just looking, it looks like Jordan's campaign arm has given Amash some money for his next run, presumably another run for Congress. I wonder if they'll take that back. This earlier this week, Jordan was, among others, saying that they completely disagree with Amash's embracing impeachment here. But that's a whole bunch of people who are in very strange positions because of this. The Club for Growth, who I'm sure you've talked about in this program before, you know, well known for its sort of principled, libertarian, conservative, who we're going to push against Republicans in name only, et cetera, et cetera. They've loved Amash over the years. They've given him awards. They think, which, you know, he gets high scores with them all the time. You know, this week they come out with something saying, we love you, but we don't agree with your own impeachment. It's going to be interesting to see what these groups do in an Amash primary, particularly if somehow the Republican National Committee and others figure out a way to try to push the scales against Amash.
It's kind of interesting that he's in favor of impeachment and Nancy Pelosi is not.
Yes, it is. It's very interesting. But again, you get into that idea of what's a principle and what's not. Amash is a guy, and I saw that the state representative, Jim Lauer, who is filed to run against Amash, if Amash runs again in this district next year, you know, is saying that Justin Amash has more in common with Rashida Tlaib of Detroit than he does the people of West Michigan and in his district. But, you know, Amash is somebody who wrote legislation with John Conyers, who used to represent that same district in Detroit. They both agreed that the Patriot Act went too far, that there should not be excessive government surveillance of Americans. And so it's not the first time that he's agreed with somebody on the other side of the aisle that government has gone too far, that government should do certain things.
What could you tell me about Jim Lauer, you know, the state rep who's is going to challenge him in the primary next year?
Ken, there's not a whole lot I can tell you because, to be honest with you, as a state rep, as such, he hasn't come across my radar here in Washington too much. I have every reason to believe that, you know, he's a viable candidate. He has certainly won in that region before. And I also believe that Representative Lauer has done some work with former Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly, who is well liked out in that area, and also who has ties with Amash over the years. So I have every reason to believe that Lauer, you know, in an open race, potentially makes some noise, potentially do well. I think he's a young man. I think he's got a lot of energy. The issue is that, you know, Amash through the years has had other people go after him, and this stance he has taken, the way he has treated the office, the seriousness with which he has approached it seems, has paid off with him. Even though he's got plenty of people in West Michigan who aren't crazy about him, it seems like he's found a way to win. And I think that if he runs again, he'll be hard to unseat, particularly if a bunch of people come into that race. I mean, it's like a Kentucky Derby or a Preakness. You know, if you get 14 horses, you get 20 horses, it's easier for a long shot to come in, for the race to go their way. you know, I think a crowded race makes it easier for Amash to hold on to the seat. If he decides to hold on to the seat, I think that's very much up in the air, too.
Here's what Lauer had to say on Fox News.
You know, at this point, Justin Amash has more in common with Rashida Tlaib than he does the average Republican primary voter in the district. So we are going to beat him on this issue, but we're also going to beat him on the fact that in 10 years in Congress, he's gotten one bill passed, and it was to rename a post office. Completely ineffective.
I guess the question is, as much as the Trump administration is aimed its guns at him, the question is, could he be defeated in a primary? And two, maybe even more important question, do you think he's going to run again? Because there's been rumors that he's looking at perhaps a presidential bid on the Libertarian Party ticket.
Yeah. Take those in order. I think the first question, if he decides to run again, and whether it's Jim Lauer or whether it's someone else comes in, a Republican who's well-known out there in that district who decides to go after him, but one, I mean, one person, I don't mean multiple people who are running against him, you know, with one person or maybe two who are very strong, who go after Amash, who end up having the support of the Trump backers. I think it's possible to beat him in a primary, possible. No one's done it before. People have tried. The Chamber of Commerce went after him with somebody a few cycles back. He didn't have any trouble winning. So sure, maybe that happens. Trump is obviously beloved among Republican voters. That field gets bigger, who knows? It's harder to beat Amash. And then even if you do beat him in a Republican primary, I do think it's the kind of race where maybe it's possible that he runs as a Libertarian. The other side of this is you're right. I mean, is he going to run? My first thought upon seeing Congressman Amash's Twitter comments last weekend was that, oh, he's out. He's running for president. You know, it's just not something you do to take on a president of your party this directly and then stick around and run in his party. Amash would be the one to try, perhaps, if that is going to happen. But I think there's a possibility he checks out of the party and runs as a Libertarian for president. I think he's probably still weighing those options. He's not somebody who's likely to talk to many people about that if he does decide to do it. I think we have to wait and see.
Because I'm thinking Michigan was a close state in 2016. If it's close again and with Amash running as a third party, it could make a difference, sort of like, you know, Ralph Nader in Florida in 2000.
Absolutely. So on that score, I think you have to look at the fact that in Michigan in 2016, Trump won by less than 11,000 votes. And Trump won Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania total by fewer voters than it takes to fill, you know, Spartan Stadium in East Lansing. I mean, in Michigan, an Amash could absolutely change the tenor of that state. So you have to think that there would be people who would look at an Amash who don't want to vote for Donald Trump and think, this guy sounds like he's got principles, I'm going to come out and vote for him. And by doing so, be part of that, yes, make it maybe even more competitive, if not flip it back.
Todd Spangler is the Washington correspondent for the Detroit Free Press. Todd, it was great having you on the show.
Thank you for having me. You can go your own way.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the last child of a former vice president to run for the Senate? The answer, Skip Humphrey. Born Hubert Horatio Humphrey III, Skip Humphrey ran for the same Minnesota Senate seat his late father once held in 1988, but he lost to Republican incumbent David Durenberger. And the randomly selected winner is Jeff Sabo of Babylon, New York. Jeff wins the coveted political junkie button. And don't forget, we still have a scuttle button puzzle out there waiting to be solved. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Skip, skip, skip to Maloo. Skip, skip, skip to Maloo. Skip, skip, skip to Maloo. Skip to Maloo, my darling.
When John Lindsay sought a second term as mayor of New York City in 1969, his slogan was, It's the second toughest job in America.
And we did not have a Detroit, a Watts, or a Newark in this city. And those were no mistakes. The things that go wrong are what make this the second toughest job in America. But the things that go right are what make me want it.
And not long after he was reelected, he decided to seek the first toughest job in America.
I joined the Democratic Party today because it offers the best hope for a change in national direction and national leadership in the 1972 election. For my part, I will start now to help build this new coalition. Whether this means I'll run for president, I do not know. But it does mean that I am firmly committed to take an active part in 1972 to bring about new national leadership.
His bid for the White House didn't go very far, but Lindsay was one of several mayors of New York who felt the next logical step was higher office. The latest is Bill de Blasio, in his second term, who officially announced his candidacy last week. He was on ABC's Good Morning America.
Well, George, working Americans deserve better, and I know we can do it because I've done it here in the largest, toughest city in this country. We're putting money back in the hands of working people. And I say it very bluntly, there is plenty of money in this world, and there's plenty of money in this country. It's just in the wrong hands. We have to do things for working people. We have to put working people first. That's the difference here. I've actually done it. I've proven it can be done. We're doing things like guaranteed health care for all New Yorkers, including mental health care, the issue that Shirlane is focused on, paid sick leave, pre-K for all. These are things that change working people's lives for the better. All Americans deserve that kind of opportunity to live a better life.
One number often mentioned is 23. He's the 23rd person seeking the Democratic nomination. Another number may be more significant, 73. A recent Quinnipiac poll shows 73% of New York City Democrats are against him running. The Tonight Show's Jimmy Fallon had this perspective.
Well, you guys, after 12 years, today was the final episode of The Big Bang Theory. Yeah. Don't worry, it was also the beginning of a brand new comedy, Bill de Blasio's presidential campaign.
And for the record, the last sitting mayor elected president? None. It's never happened. Grace Rao knows all about de Blasio. She's a political reporter for New York One and the host of New York One's podcast, Off Topic on Politics. She's also the winner of the Society of Professional Journalists National Sunshine Award for her reporting on de Blasio's relationship with private consultants. Grace, it's wonderful having you on The Political Junkie.
Ken, thanks so much for having me.
Well, de Blasio's name has been mentioned as a potential candidate, I guess, ever since he won a second term in 2017. But 22 Democrats announced before he did, and people were wondering for the longest time what his plans were. Were you surprised when he got into the race?
I was not surprised, but that's because I was accompanying him on some of these political trips that he was taking this spring to early primary and caucus states. So I was with him in Nevada and New Hampshire and watched him as he interacted with voters there. And honestly, my big takeaway from those trips was just how happy he seemed. When he's in New York, he does not seem like someone who is enjoying his job. He does not seem like someone who is engaged and animated by the governance of New York City, the job that New Yorkers elected him to do. But when he is out on the trail talking about big political ideas and getting into campaign mode, he's honestly just joyful. And so when I saw that personally for myself, I thought he is going to do it no matter what the polls say.
What does he bring to the table?
Well, he would argue that what he brings to the table is executive experience and a record of actually doing things. So he's going to argue that the rest of the field, especially people like you, sitting U.S. senators, they have ideas, they have policy proposals. And he's going to point to his record in New York. He's already doing it to say, look, I'm not just talking about what I want to do. You can see what I have done in New York and what I could expand across the country. So in the clip that you played from him on the day that he launched, he talks about a lot of the issues that are now sort of core to his stump speech, things like universal pre-kindergarten, paid sick leave. He has a plan, it's very new, but a new plan to connect uninsured New Yorkers with primary care doctors. He's calling it a guarantee access to health care. And he also has a new proposal that he's trying to get through that would guarantee paid time off, essentially paid vacation time for people who work in New York and don't currently get paid time off through their employers. So he's going to make the case, look, you can see what I have done. I'm not just talk. I've been able to execute, and I want to have this, what I've done to New York, go national effectively.
Of course, other things that are going on in New York he may not be as proud of, such as, you know, tremendous homelessness or his attempt to turn around city schools, which didn't seem to be successful.
Exactly. So he has a much more mixed record, obviously, than the one that he's presenting to the public. We have record levels of homelessness in New York. The city's public housing authority, which is home to 400,000 New Yorkers, has been mired in major problems, scandal. There is now much more federal oversight that is required of the entire authority, and that has been plagued by major problems on the mayor's watch. And then when it comes to education, universal pre-kindergarten has widely been hailed as a success. Very early on in his tenure, he added universal pre-K for four-year-olds in New York, and he's looking to expand it to three-year-olds. But his reforms of the rest of the education system, the K-12 part, have been much less successful. And in fact, he's recently kind of pulled back and admitted that his main plan to turn around the school system really wasn't working. And so the city is now trying a different tack.
There's also been some questions about ethics.
Yes, he has had a lot of problems when it comes to his fundraising practices. The U.S. Attorney's Office, the Manhattan DA's office, both of them investigated his political activities and his fundraising extensively. And while neither of them brought charges against him, they issued a very rare public rebuke of the mayor. And the U.S. Attorney's Office, for instance, found that the mayor was soliciting money from donors who had business before the city of New York, and then was intervening in city business on behalf of donors. So there has been a lot of ethical questions and a real cloud over his administration, especially when those investigations were in full swing, about his fundraising practices. And he has a long record. It's very clear that this is someone who is not shying away from asking people who want to do business with the city, who may need favors from City Hall. He's going and asking those people for money. And he, even with these investigations, he hasn't changed his approach very much.
And while he talks about how different he is from President Trump, I keep hearing that his relationship with the media is almost Trump-like.
Well, it is and it isn't. So there are some parallels there. The mayor has a lot of disdain for the City Hall press corps. That is very clear. We know about that also from the reporting that I did about the mayor's relationships with outside consultants led us to be able to access thousands of pages of emails that the mayor exchanged with his aides and at City Hall and outside of City Hall, his advisors. And those showed kind of the mayor in what he assumed was a protected setting, really denouncing the press coverage that he was getting, very thin-skinned about it. And he has never been able to effectively harness the power of the press to help him push his agenda and help him win over the public. And that's been a problem for him since day one. I think part of the issue was that when he ran for mayor in 2013, he did not have the support of any of the major newspapers in New York. He was largely ignored by the press until he started surging late in the game. And I think he got into City Hall and his feeling was, you know, I was able to win this election without the media. I don't need them in order to govern. And I think that that has been a big mistake for him. And it may be behind what we saw in a recent poll out this week that showed de Blasio has the highest unfavorability rating of the entire Democratic presidential field among Democratic voters nationwide. It's 34% or 35% unfavorable. Only 14% say they have a favorable view of him. And that may be because people know of him through what they read in the press, and he's gotten a lot of critical press coverage.
You know, I remember lying on a beach in Miami in 1972. You remember 1972, don't you?
Not quite.
I remember lying on a beach in Miami in 1972 and watching a plane fly overhead with a banner that read, Forest Hills says beware of Lindsay. This is in Florida. So, I mean, the point, of course, John Lindsay's approval ratings back home were not great, shall we say. Good Morning America's George Stephanopoulos brought up de Blasio's polling numbers.
There's a poll about a month ago, Quinnipiac poll, that showed 76% of New York voters, 73% of New York Democrats say you shouldn't run. So what should the rest of the country think when so many of your fellow New Yorkers are saying don't run?
You know, I got elected mayor, but 73% of the vote originally, reelected with 67% of the vote. I think you'd agree that the poll that actually matters is the election. So New Yorkers have twice said that they wanted me to lead them.
Of course, Grace, wanting him as mayor is not the same as wanting him as president.
Right, exactly. And there are a lot of New Yorkers who feel like this campaign, he's abandoning New York, essentially, that they elected him to run the city. And this is more than a full-time job, as John Lindsay said, the second toughest job in America. So how do you do that job while you're also crisscrossing the country and asking people to vote for you? So I think the source of frustration with de Blasio's presidential aspirations is, you know, on both of those fronts. Some people don't think he would be a good president. Other people think he needs to focus on what's happening in New York. But as for the protesters, you know, the banner flying overhead in Florida, I was just with him in South Carolina at a barbecue restaurant in Orangeburg, and he was, you know, trying to work the room, talk to people there. And outside, there were three protesters. A retired NYPD officer who lives in South Carolina now was out front with a big sign representing one of the city's biggest police unions, who are very upset with the mayor. They're in the midst of contract negotiations, but there were three protesters outside. So people who he has people who are willing to travel and make their displeasure with him known in these primary states, which is something that some of the rest of the field doesn't have to contend with in the same way.
Well, if he's not making much headway in the polls, and I don't know how much money he's raising, but is he in danger of being excluded from next month's debate?
He is in danger, absolutely. His advisors are already, this is not a good sign, they are already downplaying the significance of that debate. One of them said to me, you know, do you really want to be the 20th person on a stage to have 45 seconds to talk about climate change? And I thought, gee, you definitely want to be on that stage, because if you're not, you're not even considered in the top 20 candidates in the Democratic field. So they are, I think, trying to set expectations very low when it comes to this debate. The mayor has gotten 1% in three national polls, which is one of the requirements. But if it looks like there's going to be more than 20 people who qualify, then he may have to get some higher numbers in order to guarantee a spot on the debate stage. So as of right now, he is not a sure thing for that first debate.
Do you think he's in the race to stay? What do you think?
So I do think that he is in the race for longer than other candidates might be were they in his position. And part of my thinking around that is that he's gotten into this race knowing that his poll numbers are abysmal, knowing that he is going to have to sort of play a long game if he wants to have any sort of respectable showing at all. I also think that while he may have trouble fundraising, he is still the sitting mayor of New York City, and there are a lot of people and a lot of companies with a lot of money that operate in New York. And when the sitting mayor of New York City calls you and asks you for a contribution, I think a lot of those people are just going to write a check. It's sort of the cost of doing business, the reality that we live in. And so I do think that while he's not going to be putting up fundraising numbers the way the front runners are, that he does have the ability to raise some money. And if he has a lean operation, that could be enough to sustain his campaign, you know, maybe even up to Iowa and New Hampshire.
Grace Rao is a political reporter with New York One. Grace, you are fantastic. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
If I can make it there, I'll make it.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. And we've added many more items to the Political Junkie store. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to Ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
I am gonna make a brand new start of it. It's up to you, New York.